God help you if you use voiceover in your work, my friends. God help you. It's flaccid, sloppy writing.
I don't want you to be the guy in the PG-13 movie everyone's really hoping makes it happen. I want you to be like the guy in the rated R movie, you know? The guy you're not sure whether or not you like yet.
Hello and welcome to this edition of the Get Your Film Fix podcast. I'm Brantley Palmer, and I'm joined by Lee Carlo and Mr. Chapin Hemingway for this edition. We're going to be looking at Young Adult, now in theaters, with Charlize Theron, directed by Jason Reitman. And then we're going to go into a discussion of directors who speak for our current generation. And then we're going to wrap everything up with our top five high school relationships in movies.
Here's the deal. Buddy Slade and I are meant to be together, and I'm here to get him back.
I'm pretty sure he's married with a kid on the way.
No, kid's here. I'm cool with it. I mean, I've got baggage, too.
I would keep all of this to yourself. I would find a therapist.
That new baby of his is just darling.
Have you seen it? Up close?
Shot.
You know what? Oh my God.
She's an old-time ambassador.
God, you are a piece of work.
Can I help you find something?
I'm going to a rock concert with an old flame.
Let's show him what he's been missing.
No, he's seen me recently. He knows. But his wife hasn't seen me in a while, so...
So, Brantley, last week on the Warhorse podcast, we discussed A.O. Scott's assertion that he recommends people surrender to the sentimentality of War Horse. We found the film to be – we found ourselves unable to do that because we found it over-sentimental and corny. And Lee, you have any other adjectives to throw in there?
Garbage is a word that comes to mind.
I think you could put forth the point that Young Adult is in many ways – the complete opposite of War Horse in those terms. Is there anything, without giving away your guys' positions on your feelings on the film, is there a mentality one would benefit from going into this movie, much like A.O. Scott recommended you surrender to the sentimental in War Horse?
Yeah. Kind of, although it's not really something. It would be very difficult to do this without having heard a certain kind of opinion on the movie, because you know it's marketed very much as a comedy, and in many senses it's not a comedy. It's kind of it's much darker. It's very much a character piece, but it's much darker, and it has some amusing moments, but that's mostly coming from the awkwardness of the situations created by the character in this piece. So going into it expecting a comedy could prove detrimental to your opinion of the movie. So I guess if you were going to prepare yourself or surrender something, it would be to look at this movie much more as a drama than a comedy. But other than that, I don't know if there's a specific thing, or definitely not something as concrete and obvious as surrendering to the sentimentality of War Horse.
Yeah, I mean, I see what you're saying, Lee. I don't know if I would necessarily not categorize it as a comedy, though. I think it is. It's just a very dark comedy. And I would agree that it's also a character piece as well of Charlize Theron's character. But I just think it's a really, really dark comedy, almost in the vein of like Todd Solondz a little bit, although I think it's lighter than that. When we did our Terry podcast weeks and weeks ago, I kind of called Terry like Todd Solondz light, like a diet Todd Solondz, and that's kind of what Young Adult felt like. But I would say there's even more humor in it and less of the really awkward, like embarrassing stuff that you find in like Terry or a Todd Solondz film. So I don't know. I mean, I think it is funny, but you have to be like ready to laugh at like the, you know, hopelessness and bleakness of like certain people's situations rather than
inappropriate things. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, I think that's just what it is, just being able to laugh at those and accepting that. What about you, Chapin?
I mean, I don't want to, as per Chapin's request, I don't want to give too much away, but like, suggesting that you kind of like laugh at these characters' expenses to some extent is difficult, especially when it comes to like a character like Patton Oswalt's character in this movie. Like, you know, it's portrayed, if you want to use the term dark, fine, but it's portrayed so, I mean, I'll use dark. It's portrayed so dark that like it's hard to even approach a point where you can laugh at someone's expense. Like it's not done in a way that you can, you know, surrender yourself to that.
Well, I'm not saying necessarily laugh at a character's expense. I'm saying laugh at like the situations these characters find themselves in. Not
right,
necessarily
I can see
laughing
that.
At like Patton Oswalt just because he has, you know, certain handicaps within the film. But Patton Oswalt's a very funny character in the movie, not because of like his character is the way he is, but because of the, you know, the humor his character brings to the film and like the situations. Like for instance, when like there's a scene where. There's another handicapped person who's in a wheelchair and like Patton Oswalt hates him because he's so happy about everything and Patton Oswalt's, you know, not.
I mean, right. I think I would argue with you that he's laughing, we're laughing at that character in the wheelchair because he's happy. I think he's just overtly overly enthusiastic, which I think is sort of the antithesis of this entire film. And mm-hmm. if there is a moment when, I'm glad you pointed that out, that moment, Brantley, but if there is a moment when we can sort of coalesce behind these two protagonists, at least in my opinion, it's that moment, because you see sort of what this movie is trying to fight against, which is this, you know, I mean, there is really no nice moments in this movie. There's nothing really I think the character in the wheelchair would hate this movie because he, you know, it's so not only is it just not positive, but it sort of relishes in its cynicism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the character in the wheelchair would love Warhorse and hate this movie.
Exactly.
I think the point you're trying to make.
Exactly. Anyways.
Well, now that we've covered that.
What was your question, Lee, originally?
Well, perhaps now we can reveal a bit more. I don't know if either one of you read Michael's review of Young Adult, which got posted on getyourfilmfix.com today. Yep. He had some extremely harsh words to say about this movie, and I actually agreed with quite a bit that he said, but to a much lesser extent. I didn't hate it nearly as much, but I disliked it for all of those reasons. Like, I mean,
I purposely avoided it. Is there anything you can share?
I mean, he kind of goes through it like section by section. He says how we should be feeling as an audience through each part of the film. So he kind of says it opens, we expect a comedy, then we see that it's actually more just like this really awkward woman doing like in this absolutely like crazy idea that she has and like dealing with that, and then it gets kind of dark and dealing with like how she's relating to all these people, and he basically just goes step by step about how like your thought process will change over the course of this movie, and then he goes on to point out that the script sucks, which I completely agree with. I think this thing had no direction and so much of it made no sense, and so much happened for the sake of just having it happen. Like the relationship between, or I shouldn't just say the relationship, but the getting together of Charlize Theron and Patton Oswalt made no sense. And if the motivation for that was that Charlize Theron was drinking the whole movie, so you could just say she's a drunk, she didn't know what she was doing, then shame on this movie, because that's pathetic.
It was nominated for a WGA.
Yeah, I know. That's today. Like, that's what I thought was funny too, because Michael posted his article today, and then the Writers Guild of America nominations came out and nominated Young Adult for one of their awards, which I thought was funny. But I don't think a movie's pathetic just because like they're laying a groundwork that someone's an alcoholic. In fact, she even in her most, you know, clear moments in this movie, she even kind of realizes and accepts the fact that she is an alcoholic, and every time we hear her try to bring it up, it kind of gets like laughed off or put away because, you know, the people around her just really aren't listening to her. Like when she tries to say it to her parents, it's the only moment she's really like very honest with them, and they just kind of laugh when she says.
I agree, but to use that as their motivation for Patton Oswalt's character and Charlize Theron's character to get together the way they did, is just cheap. I mean, you know, first of all, they created a character, and call me cynical or like or whatever you want, but they created a character in Patton Oswalt that is the epitome of a loser. Like, everything that can go wrong has gone wrong for this character. He's fat, he has a lousy job, he's ugly, he's crippled, he's a dork, he plays with action figures, he has a distillery in his garage, he spends all his time by himself. Like, every single cliche that you can have in the book to make a sad sack of a character, they employ here. And then they take Charlize Theron and portray her as a selfish, you know, a selfish person who doesn't really care about anything other than, like, exactly what she wants in a given moment. And doesn't care what it does to anybody else's happiness. And then we're supposed to accept that just because she got drunk one night, she sleeps with this guy. I mean, I just didn't buy it. And their platonic relationship actually kind of had me for a little while. I felt like he was kind of a portal into, like, you know, deep inside her character that she wouldn't let out for anybody else. And then they just go and ruin it with that whole sex scene, I guess we'll call it.
I thought Patton Oswalt's character actually showed really how just shallow and terrible of a person Charlize Theron's character was, because even with all that's happened to him, he still has a far better outlook on life than she does. And I don't think necessarily all the things that they show about him make him out to be such a, you know, a loser. I mean, painting action figures, yeah, you can say that's a little juvenile and stuff, and he calls himself a geek. But having a distillery in your garage where you're, like, welding your own oak barrels, I'm sorry, that doesn't make you a loser. That's pretty badass, in my opinion.
But these are cliches, though.
Yeah, they're painting him as a dork. I mean, I think, and he admits it, too. I don't think that's what you're arguing.
I mean, I think it's cool that he has a distillery, but let's not quibble over the details, okay?
Why did the fact that they slept together
ruin
their relationship?
Well, because it didn't make any sense. Like, it's actually a lot of the same reasons that the speech that his sister gives her at the end of the movie kind of contradicts everything we've seen up until that point. Like, you get there, Charlize Theron starts to accept that she's crazy and that she, you know, needs to kind of look at herself and, like, realize what she's done here and how she can fix it. And then we get a speech from the sister that says, like, no, don't fix it. We all wish we were you. Go back to Minneapolis and live your life exactly the same way. All lessons learned, forget about them. And then, so you're kind of taking everything we've seen up to that point and flipping it on its head. The same thing can be said about the relationship with Patton Oswalt and Charlize Theron. You have a platonic relationship, and I totally agree with you, Brantley, that you see what a bad person is, basically, what a bad person Charlize Theron's character is through Patton Oswalt, and that works. And their platonic relationship, is as strange as it may be, that she would spend any time with him at all, it works in the context of the movie and in kind of a quirky Diablo Cody type of way, but it takes that platonic relationship and it completely flips it on its head, and you get something entirely different, and it doesn't work within the context of the movie. It's out of place.
No, I'll tell you why I think it does work in the context of the movie. I think at that point in the movie, she's just made an absolute fool of herself to all the people in her old soul town, the people who had put her on a pedestal before and thought she was someone better than she was because she's a writer and living in Minneapolis. She's drunk again when she already thinks she's an alcoholic. And so she's at her lowest point she's ever been. And she just wants someone who's going to like her for who she is and be attracted to her for who she is when she can't get Buddy Slade, who's this guy that she's been trying to rip away from his wife throughout this entire movie. She's faced the ultimate amount of rejection at this point in the movie. And she just wants someone who's going to be there to love her and to hold her for who she is. And the only person in the movie who knows how she is Patton Oswalt's character. Okay. So that's why I think it actually did work for me.
Well, my problem, I think if you're going to talk about I think that was a predictable path for those two characters to go down, and I think I saw it coming. I think I was sort of hoping that it wouldn't, but I accepted that it was. But I feel like the previous scene, the scene you just mentioned, Brantley, where Charlize Theron gets too drunk at the naming ceremony of her ex-boyfriend's wife's child, and the wife spills something on her and she sort of flips out and says all this stuff. That to me was simultaneously the worst and best scenes in the movie. As for the movie, I felt that scene was awful. But for the character of Charlize Theron's character, I thought that was our only moment when we could empathize with her or sympathize with her, and not for the reason that that you may think, not for the revelation that's comes out in that scene. We suddenly realize she's a lot more self-aware and intelligent than we thought before, which right. I like, which made me like feel something for that character for the first time in the whole movie. But leading up to that point, you sort of think it's sort of on the tip of your tongue, that idea, because she's like a writer and successful, and you kind of want her to be intelligent, but she has this ridiculous idea about, you know, going back and stealing back her college or high school boyfriend. And so that was my problem. I don't know if that makes sense to you guys, but
I mean, for me, I don't think it was a, you know, like a cheap thing to reveal the information that's revealed in that scene. And I don't think it was necessarily just like a pity attempt to get information for her either. I think it actually wraps, like, puts everything in perspective when we realize why seeing the baby picture at the very beginning put the whole idea in her head in the first place. You know, it kind of gives credence to the whole reasoning, because I think actually without it, we kind of would be wondering, well, why did this suddenly happen where she felt the need to try to go find this old flame she hasn't seen in, you know, what, a decade almost? I mean,
right.
But, I mean, so I think it actually lends a lot more information to her character and why she did what she did.
Right.
But I don't think it was an attempt to get sympathy for her at all. I think it was just a key piece of information that's brought forth at that point that gives you an idea behind her reasoning.
Well, Brantley, what I would argue to that is I don't think this movie I don't think Diablo Cody or Jason Reitman cared at all about the information being put forth. I mean, it was clear in the depiction of this character who we're with, you know, who's on screen in every scene that we don't need to know everything about her. I think what was important throughout the movie up to that point was her actions that occurred on screen, not what happened before and everything else. I mean, a key piece, if you're going to ask about like information about her past to explain her present behavior, I mean, why, I think a key piece of information would have been, why did her previous marriage dissolve, and other details. I mean, I think you're right that the revelation does connect things a little bit, but I don't think that they care to do that. I don't think the filmmaker's intention was to say, okay, well, our audience needs to know why these things happen. I mean, they seem to leave out plenty of details that I think were extraneous, and you could argue that particular detail was extraneous, because I think the focus of this movie, they're not trying to. I mean, this was what my problem with this movie, and perhaps it, and for a lot of critics I read, it was what they loved about it. But this movie doesn't really espouse anything. They're not really trying to say anything about her character, significant or anything like that. I mean, that's sort of the point of the movie. She doesn't change. Nothing evolves. There's no character arc. You know, Lee, like what you say, the Charlie Kaufman quote you put into last week's.
Overcoming obstacles right. to succeed in the end.
Exactly. That's you know, conspicuously, obviously left out of this movie. So that particular detail, I don't think is important to the plot. I mean, there really isn't a plot here. And so my ultimate problem was this, and maybe we can discuss this, and if we want to stay on the topic, we can. But I mean, I found this movie very unpleasant. It wasn't something I was enjoying while I watched it. That isn't to say it wasn't effective in what it was doing. I think that was exactly their intentions, and I think they achieved it incredibly. But I didn't enjoy the experience. But in some of the examples you guys brought up before, like Todd's Salons and movies like that, and I'm thinking of also like early Alexander Payne movies like Election, where, you know, the people involved and the circumstances are so awful and bleak, and it was difficult to get through. But at the end of it, there really wasn't a, like, I didn't see the objective at the end of the road. I think for me, if I'm going to go through all that, there needs to be some sort of cathartic moment or some sort of statement or a question raised or something substantive to grab hold of in order to sit through all that. And I really felt like through the whole movie that if there was something like that, I was missing it.
Well, I felt absolutely completely the opposite on almost every account you just brought up. Like, I, sitting through this movie, I had no issues with it. It wasn't until afterwards that I felt like both Diablo Cody and Jason Reitman brought pretty much nothing to this movie, and that any positives it had going for it were a credit to Charlize Theron. I mean, the best parts of this movie for me were scenes when she first sees Patrick Wilson, who plays Buddy, her ex boyfriend, and they were so awkward. But Jason Reitman didn't do anything cinematically that made it that way. It was just her performance. I felt like she just like played those scenes so well that it was so uncomfortable, but like intentionally uncomfortable. And that for me worked. And much of the movie, even as it was starting to like have, you know, scenes that I didn't like and unmotivated actions, I still never really had an issue with it until I got out, and I just was disappointed because Jason Reitman, I feel like, gotten such good graces with me with Thank You for Smoking that even after Up in the Air, which was disappointing, and Juno, which I didn't love, I think was a little overrated, you know, I still had a lot of hope for this movie because he was directing it, and I just feel like it's kind of right up his alley, and it just, I felt like he brought nothing to this. Like, anybody could have directed this.
I think this was all of this was completely intentional. I think that what you're talking about, that sort of lack of vision, if I'm describing that correctly, was absolutely intentional on both in the screenwriting and in the directing.
But I don't understand what you mean then. Like, how? I mean, then what is he doing with it then? To suggest that you're directing a movie that has no vision is like the antithesis of directing.
I think that you are mistaking a lack of vision for his vision that this film isn't saying anything, or his
right
depiction of Charlize Theron's character as someone who doesn't change, grow, etc., all the things we talk about. And in fact, the lack of joy in each scene, I mean, I didn't think this movie was funny at all. But the lack of anything to really grab hold of and any heart, for lack of a better word, was completely intentional.
I hate to quote adaptation again, but like, I mean, you can't have a script where characters don't change, and you can't, like, when nothing happens, you know, where there's no story, you know. I mean, all right.
You love the movie that had no story and no character development.
What did you? What movie?
Have a story. Sorry. It had a lot of character
Meek's cut off. Oh, Meek's cut off.
I haven't seen it.
If I can just get a word in, I think both of you don't get enough credit to the writer and director in different ways. I think when it comes to the script shaping, I think you're underselling what Diablo Cody brought to it. I mean, I don't think it's like an amazing, like, Oscar nominated one, but I think that the fact that she reveals that piece of information we were talking about before in it, it's a plant and payoff. I mean, the plant at the beginning is she's seeing the photos of the baby and then decides to go on this, you know, trip back to her hometown, and we're trying to figure out why the photos of the baby bring it up. And then that's the payoff that she lands later on during that scene. And then Lee, I don't think you're giving Jason Reitman enough credit for creating such, you know, awkward and uncomfortable scenes, which was, you know, the point of so much of his direction in it. So, but I'm kind of on both sides with you here.
Can I interrupt you here? Okay.
Yep.
In a movie that has basically no plot, no story.
Sure there is.
I mean, okay, you're right. There is a story. But you could argue that both these filmmakers are kind of indifferent to the outcome of the relationship, right? I mean, whatever story they're trying to expose here, they don't. That's not their intention. They're not here to tell you what we're not. in representing Charlize Theron's character as they do, they are inherently divorcing the audience's ability to sympathize and thus lock on. And because we don't like her, we don't care what happens to her, which I think is exactly what they're trying to achieve here. But
well, I would agree with that, but I don't necessarily think you need a protagonist that has to be, you know, someone that we like just to see what happens to them.
I agree.
I mean, there's all kinds of protagonists. But
I think my point is that the substance of this movie then is not in the plot, not in what happens and what is revealed to her character, but rather, you know, sort of the way she occurs in every scene. And so then my point being that I don't see the intention of revealing that piece of information at the end in that last scene as a way of developing the plot. I don't think that is anything at all, or making us look back and as a motivation for her character. I really don't see what that brings to their, I mean, in the context of her character, yes, I see that that is important to the development and why she came in and did that. But to the overall movie, I don't see its importance. To the movie in Diablo Cody and Jason Reitman's eyes, I do not see the importance of that particular piece of information.
But see, I disagree with your assertion that the plot doesn't matter then because we're given a protagonist who we don't sympathize for. I think she does have a character arc. It's a character arc that continues to go up and then all the way comes into literally a full circle and then back to where she was before. And I know that might seem, you know, ridiculous, but I think it's actually the truth. She goes through this whole trip back to her hometown, goes through all kinds of ridiculous, embarrassing scenes that she puts herself in,
right,
has these moments of clarity where she realizes what she's doing is horrible to herself. And yet by the end of it, the conversation at the end that she has with Patton Oswalt's sister kind of reaffirms her beliefs to go back to the city, you know, have the confidence she had in herself before, even if she is a miserable, you know, alcoholic. But it's allowing her to get past Buddy Slade, which is what had held her up for the entire movie, and regain getting that old flame back. So I do think it's an arc. It's just an arc that goes into a circle and then goes slightly forward a little bit because she's going back to the city and can let him go.
Okay. Well, the last thing I'll say is, I mean, I think that's absolutely right, but I still don't think that the pieces of information that we get. Okay, let's spoiler alert. If you haven't seen the movie and you don't want to know, turn off now. But the fact that she revealed that she had a miscarriage of Buddy Slade's child does one thing. It explains her motivation for going on this ridiculous goose chase, wild goose chase, which in my opinion, and it seems up to that point in the opinion of the filmmakers, was totally irrelevant. I mean, why do we care why she's going on this journey? We don't care what happens to her anyways. We don't care what happens. I don't think they care what happens. She's so awful and so uninteresting and lacks any heart, or we lack any heart for her, that it doesn't matter what motivates her. And so, you know, I mean, I think we shouldn't spend too much time talking about this because, I obviously think it doesn't matter, but...
Yeah. I mean, I think you think it doesn't matter. I still think it matters, even if, you know, we don't necessarily care for her as a protagonist. I still think it obviously matters to the movie because, I mean, Jason Reitman and Diablo Cody could have done anything they wanted to with this movie. They could have had the Hollywood ending where she checks herself into rehab and then is able to be friends with Buddy afterwards, even though she's made such an embarrassment and fool of herself. I mean, they could have had any number of different things, and they chose to go the way they did, which means that they obviously care about the path that her character takes throughout the movie.
My overall consensus of this movie is that, like always, Diablo Cody scribbled a bunch of cliches on a piece of paper. Jason Reitman filmed them, and then Charlize Theron somehow turned it into something watchable, all the while acting against Patrick Wilson, who was a brick wall in this movie.
Why do guys like you and I know what a tefay is? Is this essential to our survival? In the hunter-gatherer sense of the word? No. What are we then?
Consumers.
Right. We are consumers. We are byproducts of a lifestyle obsession. Murder, crime, poverty, these things don't concern me. What concerns me are celebrity magazines, television with
500 channels. Some guy's name on my underwear. Rogaine, Viagra, Lester. It's all going down, man. So fuck off with your sofa units and string green stripe patterns. I say never be complete. I say stop being perfect. I say let's evolve. Let the chips fall where they may. The things you own end up owning you.
All right. Directors that speak to our generation.
All right. Yeah, this is an interesting topic. Chapin, you thought of this idea, and I don't know if you read my article that I wrote, I don't know, like a week or two ago about David Fincher. I was suggesting he makes movies specifically for our generation based on kind of like interest levels. Where and this would stem from Jason Reitman, who, of course, directed Up in the Air, which, you know, upon its release was pegged the movie of the time, you know. And it was kind of an out with the old, in with the new plot type of thing that was going on that would speak very much to our generation. And then Thank You for Smoking and Juno are both kind of relatable in many ways to our generation. So I think that you're right. That's kind of where this conversation can stem from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, when I was compiling lists for this, I was just trying to think of directors who who in the films they've made that the characters and the ideas kind of embodied what our current generation is. And I think that's difficult because, I mean, we're all in our mid-20s, mid to later 20s, and, you know, most of the directors who are working out there are going to be older than that. So I think you have a lot of voices that embodied, like, a lot of the 90s or, like, growing up in the 80s. So I actually found a kind of a difficult list to put together. I mean, I don't know about you guys, but...
Well, Bradley, I think that speaks to a greater point, that which is film, especially of all the sort of media, is always behind the times. And I think that's just because there's so much corporate influence and because movies are so expensive to make, they take a lot more time, obviously, but also a lot more influence to get made. So, you know, whereas today someone can produce an album on, you know, completely by themselves on a computer, or, you know, write a novel or blog or whatever, making a feature length film, a Hollywood movie, it's a little bit more difficult, and getting your vision across can be harder and more time consuming. And so you look at the history of cinema, and you know, this could be a mini segment of Get Your Film History with Get Your Film Fix. You know, the sort of free love hippie movement of the 60s and civil rights didn't really seem to affect film until the 70s. I mean, the 70s is really when or in the late 60s, early 70s, when things started to transition into bringing that philosophy and mentality into movies. Most of the civil rights things and movements and the lovin's and whatever happened in the 60s, but we didn't get those revolutionary movies until the 70s. So I think that's a good point.
I think the interesting thing about like movies that are speaking to or that very much suggest they're movies of the time these days get overlooked because they're usually bad, because very much of what this our time is right now is kind of the continual advances of technology, and you know even if this is a little bit late, cell phones and the internet and stuff like that, and movies are being made like called cellular and stuff like that, you know, that are employing these pieces of technology that I guess are supposed to be very relatable to our generation, but they're not good movies, so it's hard to kind of pinpoint them as movies, even in the same classes as Reitman's movies. Is anybody listening?
Right.
Oh yeah, I'm listening.
I know what you're saying.
I think the films have sped up in terms of catching up with that simply because technology has allowed them to. You know, they've really caught up because of that.
Right.
You know, like the cellular or think about, you know, just any films now where, you know, there's massive amounts of social networking in them, or where, you know, the phones that they're using are all iPhones now because
we're doing Google searches.
And you look at movies from 2003 and you're seeing like Nokia phones or like the flip phones, and you think, wow, that looks really dated now. Simply because that's, you know, it just wasn't, where we are now is just so further ahead of what we are there. So I feel like in films now, they're trying to make sure that all the technology in there is like the absolute up to date as it possibly can be.
Well, it's interesting that this is going to get brought up. We got an email at feedback@getyourfilmfix.com suggesting that we review this short film that's on Funny or Die. And I took a look at it and wrote a little blurb up, which I think I'm going to post tomorrow. But I didn't really like the movie a whole lot, so I'm toying with the idea of just, you know, sending an email back to them. But it's basically like a zombie horror comedy movie. It's like 6 minutes long, but they continuously make this joke about the Google Calendar that like schedules when they're supposed to be out haunting people and stuff, and it just kind of is like an updated version of a zombie movie. You know what I mean? By like bringing this very relevant and topical thing into a genre that's been around for a long time now, and so that is the kind of thing that we see all the time. And I don't think that necessarily means that it's speaking to our generation. Like, that's not any different than making a joke in The Apartment about, you know, something that was going on in that time period. You know what I mean?
Like, what about a film like The Social Network? I think that movie speaks specifically to our generation, because I mean, Leah, as you said on that, or as Jeremy said on that podcast, when you guys reviewed it, that literally this was happening just down the street from us, while we were living in Cambridge, Jeremy and I. But we, you know, we are very much the Facebook generation. We were in college when it came out, and so we can relate to it. And I think it very much captured the, I don't think it necessarily spoke to our generation, but it was a representation of our generation, a representation of the time period. I think we're talking about two things that are occasionally mutually exclusive. We looked back at those movies in the 70s, and they spoke to that time period. I mean, they were a little bit behind, but we, you know, Vietnam was a huge cultural and social of huge cultural and social significance, and we had a lot of Vietnam films and et cetera. I mean, I think that's an obvious point. But what will people look back at in our generation and say that's a film that defines the time period? And I would say that the Social Network very much does that.
But I mean, it's a really interesting question, because it's simply the study of film history in many ways. Like, you know, to understand film history, you have to understand the history that was going on during the production of the films themselves. So right. You can, you know, and the same could be said about The Social Network in 50 years. And I think the interesting thing is that, you know, I don't want to call the launching of Facebook and social networking in general, the Vietnam War of our time, you know, but like, I don't think there's going to be another Facebook movie made, whereas there's countless Vietnam movies made. Right now, there's, you know, there's all sorts of Iraq war movies being made, both good and bad and stuff. But like, there's something that you're absolutely right. Like, I feel like people are going to look back much more on The Social Network as a movie for this generation than they are on any of these movies about the Iraq war.
All right. So for our top five this week, we are doing high school relationships in films. So I guess it can be viewed many different ways. I mean, I guess it could be high school relationships while they're happening in high school. It could be high school relationships after the fact as they've grown older. I mean, that's kind of what Young Adult was, the high school relationship between Buddy Slade and Charlize Theron's character.
Mavis.
And Mavis, thank you.
We never said her name. We'll point that out. We do know what it is.
It's Mavis. So I guess I'll throw it over to you, Lee, and you can give us any criteria you have, and you're number five.
Yeah, I actually tried to like kind of mix it up here as opposed to like picking one or narrowing it down necessarily. I left it open to like have kind of a lot of different reasons why these worked as high school relationships or like you said, like even they could be crushes or some version of this topic. So for my top five, I went with Thor Birch and Wes Bentley as Jane Berman and Ricky Fitz in American Beauty. And I went with that one specifically because of the unlikelihood of the relationship.
Good pick.
Yeah, Taven, I have a feeling you don't like American Beauty.
Not really.
It hasn't aged well for me. I was a big fan when I first saw it.
There's
over
a movie
time,
that represents the generation and then sort of is kind of irrelevant.
Mean, that's exactly how I feel about that movie. So, but at the same time, like for this list, I feel like that's a worthy pick. So I went with it.
Yeah.
Cool.
Okay, whose turn is it?
You are. You're up, Chapin.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that. Okay.
No, that's all right.
So I did – I had a lot of fun with this, and I did – I basically just took girls from high school movies that I felt I kind of liked and sort of represented girls that I – from my high school experience. You see what I mean? So they all they were all part of a relationship and most of the time with the protagonist. So it still fits, but – they sort of represent different aspects of my romantic desires when I was in.
I cannot wait to hear this stuff.
I'm gonna give you their names, and I want to see if you guys can guess what movie they're from. Okay.
All right.
So my number five is Mary Hatch. That's her maiden name, by the way. You guys know who that is?
Nope.
Nope.
Her maiden, her full name is, just a moment. Sorry. Her full name is Mary Hatch Bailey. Does that ring any bells?
It's a Wonderful Life.
Correct.
Yeah.
She, you know, he comes back, from, he was not really away or he went to college or something. And then he comes back and she's still in high school and has a crush on him and, you know, they fall into the pool.
Yeah, the dance. That's a good pick. Yeah.
I kind of like
it. All right.
Good old wholesome girl. That's my good old wholesome girl next door pick.
Yeah, and you'd lasso the moon for her, right?
Huh?
You'd lasso the moon for her.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Oh, Mary. Oh, Mary. Mary.
All right, good pick. So for my list, I'm calling it my John Hughes Memorial list. There are no John Hughes films on my list. They're all relationships that, as I'm looking at it, are happening while they're in high school. Although I didn't necessarily have to be that they are romantically involved. In fact, I took it as if one character was romantically interested in the other, then it counted for my list. That's really only I need to clarify that for one pick, and you'll see why shortly. But my number five, I don't think you guys will be able to guess if I just give you the names. It's Lane Meyer and Monique, played by John Cusack and Diane Franklin. Do you guys know the movie?
Say Anything?
Nope. Better Off Dead.
Oh God, I hated that movie.
I have a feeling that John Cusack will come up a lot on here.
Well, John Cusack hated that movie too, Lee.
He's not on my list, actually. No John Cusack on my list.
Yeah. But no, that's my list. He's dumped, and then he tries to win her back, his girlfriend back, by going into a skiing competition, only to fall in love with this other French girl in the process. So, boom, Better Off Dead.
Does
he call out for her in the rain at some point.
Not that I recall.
And it's not a John Cusack
but
movie.
But the paperboy constantly chases after them screaming, I want my $2, because they won't pay him the $2 they owe him for the newspapers he delivers.
Okay.
And then Hamburgers Sing.
Hamburgers Sing.
All right, my number four, I just want to point out part of the reason I chose this movie is because it's like my longing for these directors to be doing something good again.
This is coming.
Because I recently saw their new trailer. It's Ben Stiller and Cameron Diaz as Ted and Mary, and There's Something About Mary.
Yeah.
Oh, good pick.
And obviously you got some good scenes when they were in high school, but then much of it is him trying to get that relationship back. But my God, did you guys see the trailer for The Three Stooges?
No,
it's looking bad.
It looks awful. In every way a movie can look awful, it looks awful.
That's disappointing.
It is.
Chapin, you're number four, sir.
Okay, in honor of your pick, Brantley, my number four is Charlie Nicholson. Lee?
Nice. High Fidelity.
Correct.
Catherine Zeta-Jones.
Mm-hmm. Wait, and were they in high school?
Yes. Their relationship happens when they're in high school. And then when he goes back and just talks about her, she was that sort of exotic, opinionated, hot woman who then turns out to be this sort of vapid, humorless.
I thought she was college, I guess. Yeah. I know his other ones were high school, but I guess I thought she was college, but
I'm pretty sure she
was
high school.
I guess I don't remember very well.
God, actually, she could have been college.
It could have been college.
Fuck. But there's other relationships in there that are high school.
Good thing I'm editing.
So, I mean, it still works.
High Fidelity works.
There you go. All right, my number four is Max Fisher in Ms. Cross, played by Jason Schwartzman and Olivia Williams in Rushmore.
Yeah.
That's why I had to clarify before, because only one's really interested in a romantic relationship there.
You have to consummate that love, I think.
But that's my number four.
Yeah.
All right. My number three, I hate to do it. It's been so long, but I do believe that I have a tie at number three. It's the same movie, and I really couldn't put one of the relationships ahead of the other, but it is Emilio Estevez and Ally Sheedy as Andrew Clark and Allison Reynolds in The Breakfast Club, as well as Molly Ringwald and Judd Nelson as Claire and Bender in The Breakfast Club.
Gotcha.
So, two relationships, one detention, love. Don't you
that was a very
forget
David,
about me.
It's a don't, very David Brent introduction don't. To that. Two loves, one detention. Love.
That just reminds me of Brent on The Simpsons.
I never saw that.
Oh, it was so funny. He was Brent. He was not Ricky Gervais. He was so much like David Brent.
All right, Chapin, right. You're number three, sir.
Okay,
I'm doing really well with Chapin. So far, I'm two for two.
My number three is Cher Horowitz.
Sounds familiar.
Cher being the operative, her first name.
Cher Horowitz is that? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know either.
Clueless.
Oh fuck! That was my guess. I didn't say it. Why didn't I say it? Because I'm like, Chapin wouldn't have Clueless on a top five. That's why I didn't say it.
Fuck you, Lee. That's a great movie.
My wife will love that pick. She loves that movie, Clueless.
I mean...
Stop swearing on the podcast, by the way.
Really?
Yeah, we got to clean it up a little bit.
Who said that?
I said that.
You swear on the podcast a lot, sir.
I know, and if you noticed, I cut them all out of the War Horse podcast.
All right. I didn't know.
Let's clean it up here. Beer, swears are for beers, this podcast.
I didn't know that we were... Okay.
This is it's a reputable website we're running here.
Yeah, it's a family site.
Currently doesn't work, by the way.
What do you mean?
Well, I was trying to read your article, and I can't get to anything here.
That makes no sense. Anyway. I'm just going to continue. So, my number three, you guys might know it from the names, is Donnie and Gretchen. Do you guys know where I'm going?
Donnie here? Darko.
There you go. Jake Gyllenhaal and Jenna Malone in Donnie Darko.
Yeah, I saw that list. I saw that on a bunch of lists for like high school relationships and stuff. I don't remember that movie very well. I also didn't love it. So
now, full disclosure here, Rushmore and Donnie Darko are both on this list because those were the two movies my wife and I watched on our first date ever, which is almost 10 years ago now.
You watched two movies on your first date?
Yeah, she came over to my house, and I had just started working at Video 2020 in Bellows Falls, Vermont, which is no longer around. And those were like the two movies I ended up taking out since I started getting free rentals, and then we ended up watching them at my house.
All right, here we go. We're gonna get real tie-in crazy here.
Ooh,
my wife and I had our first date, and we saw Thank You for Smoking, directed by Jason Reitman.
Whoa.
Director of Young Adult. What is going on here?
That is eerie, sir. Eerie.
You have anything to add?
Me?
Yeah. Did you and Tyson meet at a screening of, you know, I don't know, Rushmore or something?
Does Brantley think that Tyson and I are gay lovers? What the
no,
fuck?
No.
What would give him that idea?
No, you're seeing somebody now, right?
Yeah. Tyson.
Yeah.
So surprised.
Well, do you have a crazy tie-in with the girl you're seeing that relates to Jason Reitman or anything like this?
No.
Whose turn is it?
The first movie we saw together was the uplifting, beautiful Tree of Life.
Ah, gotcha.
You dragged her to that, and she's still dating you.
All right, Lee, I think you're up with your number two.
My number two is Nicholas Holt and Natalia Tena as Marcus and Ellie in About a Boy. Perhaps a platonic relationship, but definitely a high school crush exists. So I threw it on the list.
Cool.
Was it my turn?
You're number two.
Okay. My number two is Kat Stratford.
Don't know that one.
I feel like I should know that. That's like an 80s one, isn't it?
10 Things I Hate About You.
Ah, there you go. Well, guess not.
Julia Stiles.
Yeah. Good choice, sir.
I kind of had a thing for those like intellectual, kind of snotty girls because you knew that they'd be kind of like, you know, crazy. You know, yeah, where
your number counts. One election?
No.
That's a little bit of Shakespeare in that. That's based on Taming of the Shrew, right?
Yeah, but remember she's like really mean and kind of snotty. Like you kind of have to like tame them. Yeah, she was like really anti-men and kind of feminist. And remember, that's a great movie, by the way.
It's got some good actors in it.
Is She's All That your number one?
No.
All right, apparently.
Sorry. My number two is Jim and Judy. Do you guys know which one I'm talking about? Probably not. That's James Dean and Natalie Wood in Rebel Without a Cause.
Oh, that's a good pick.
Thank you, sir.
Even though that relationship, the birth of that relationship is so cold. And by that, I mean the girl's boyfriend dies in like this horrible car wreck. And then they're at like the hospital and they get together.
It's crazy times back then.
She must have really
things
happen
fast.
All right. Lee, my number one is Alexandra Dahlstrom and Rebecca Lelgeberg as Elin and Agnes. Ringing a bell?
Nope.
Lucas Moodyson's Show Me Love.
Ah, well, there you go. I haven't seen that. That's why it's not many bells.
I mean, I'm a really big fan of Lucas Moodyson's films, specifically Show Me Love and Together, both really excellent movies. He did a movie called Mammoth with Michelle Williams, a little bit disappointing, but still I thought a very interesting movie. Definitely a filmmaker you guys should explore.
I think a couple of those are on Netflix Instant, right? I mean, I know Mammoth is. I think
Mammoth
Together is.
Yeah.
Huh, nice. People can catch up.
Spoil yourself. Okay, my number one, you guys aren't going to get, it's Debbie Newberry from another John Cusack movie, Gross Point Blank. You don't actually see them in high school together, but they were high school sweethearts.
Gotcha. Yeah, I haven't seen that movie in forever.
It's really good. I like it a lot.
I literally have never seen that movie in forever.
Yeah, because...
There you go.
You.
I figuratively have not seen it in forever. Anyway, so my number one, I don't know if you guys will get it from just the names here. It's Brendan and Emily, and it's a more recent film in the 2000s.
Emily. Sounds Brendan familiar.
Brendan and Emily. If I tell you who they're played by, you'd probably get it. It's JGL and Emily DeRaven from Brick.
Oh, but you never seen them together.
That's tricky, yeah.
And it doesn't matter if you've never seen them together.
Were they lovers? He's, I thought they were, like, friends.
She was his ex-girlfriend, and he finds her dead, and then he sets about on a course to try to, you know, get the people who did it to her. All right, well, that's going to wrap it up for this edition of the Get Your Film Fix podcast. We want to thank everybody for listening. We want to thank Chapin for coming on and joining us today, and want to encourage everybody to check out our site, getyourfilmfix.com. We have all of our articles, reviews up there. Podcasts are all up there. We have our videos. And, you know, if you want to donate, we greatly appreciate it. There's a donate tab up there if you'd like to do that. It just keeps helping us do what we do. So any little thing really helps us out, and we appreciate it. Thanks again for listening.
I'm staying. I'm finishing my coffee. Enjoying my coffee.
And then we're going to wrap everything up with our top five high school relationships in movies. Not our own, because that'd be weird and creepy and a short list, to be honest with you guys listening. So that's what you have in store for this podcast.
I'm not sure I've been with five girls total in my entire life.
I was with one.
This is going to be the first to five.